Blog Talk Radio.
Time we put
And welcome everybody to the Dragon's Lair. And tonight's topic is the continuation of the National Socialist War on Christianity. And this one is, this version or episode is part two. And I would like to comment that there will be more shows coming up on Christianity as well. I ran into, I found on YouTube where some other people in this movement had done a show trying to prove that the founding fathers of America were Christian. I listened to part of it just for the fun of it, and I mean, I've already got a documentary that totally demonstrates they weren't Christian, and I may wind up just playing that documentary. I don't know. It's so sad, really it is. You know, you listen to these shows when you know better, and all you can do is just laugh and go, these people are either just suckers, fools, ignorant, or shills, you know? I mean, what the fuck is it, you know? They just don't get it, or they don't want to get it. I don't know. I think they're shills, to be honest, but I'm going to have some fun coming up. I've been kind of in the attack mode over the net lately. You know, I would go to one group of people and attack them and then satisfy myself that I've done the job, and then I'd move on to another one and do the same, and whether it be on Facebook or YouTube or whatever. And I don't know. I do this every once in a while just for the fuck of it. I guess it's like staying in practice what I used to do all the time. You know, that's how you kind of learn how to learn all this stuff, and that's how you learn how to fight these bastards with their tactics, et cetera, et cetera. And also, too, I ran across a very interesting picture on Facebook, and you'll see it on the show page. It's, you know, how you see these like handicap signs, you know, for parking or, you know, men's or women's restroom or whatever, and shows someone holding another individual stuffing their head in a toilet. And then underneath it says flush in English, and then below that it's flush in Braille. And so it reminded me of Bill Rice. And it's my understanding that Bill was booted from this other network. Like, they finally started to at least see some of what I was talking about anyway. But so sad, it really is. But anyway, I thought it was funny. And so I put it up on the show page. It would have been nice if I would have had that, you know, a month and a half ago. But, oh well, such is life. For the record, today is February 8th, 2014, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 20 degrees Aquarius. Again, I have no personal website or blog. I probably wouldn't have a life if I did. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. And that is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to be on my e-list, and really I don't send a whole lot out, just send me an email saying subscribe. And if you want to just write me. And I will always read all my emails. Can't guarantee I can respond to all of them. Many have written me who have not gotten any response at all. While we're on that topic, someone sent me a file for a song to play. And while I'm on that subject of music, I'll just go ahead and say this. I haven't really loaded up any new music lately. I've still got stuff in here that I haven't played yet. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to get through the rest of what I have on Elton John plus one other song tonight. And I'm going to move on to another artist. And so I'll try to fit this other song in on a, on an appropriate show, this one that this person sent me, and I haven't listened to it yet, but supposedly it's regarding Christianity, and so it may be a good one to play on the one of the shows I just described a little earlier. No calls tonight. Dog is inside, cat's on the back of my chair, and I want to go ahead and remind everybody that this part two is a continuation of a book that I have been reading, and I will give out the author's name and the title and where you can find it when I'm done. One person wrote me after I did the first show saying, yeah, I got that book. A lot of good nuggets of information in it. And so, again, I highly recommend getting this book so you can shove it in the face of your friends who think that the National Socialists were Christians. I mean, you know, why can't they just look at the goddamn flag? I guess they just thought that, oh, the swastika looked neat, and it's a good luck symbol. Let's just put that up there, and that'll work. Like, I mean, you know, a bunch of simple simultons or something. I mean, you know, I don't know. It's like, duh. People are so goddamn fucking retarded. Anyway, and again, this book is geared to people who would read WorldNet Daily, neocons, Tea Partiers, people who are like, you know, pro-Christian and Christian conservative, you know, that are, you're probably never going to be able to convince them to become National Socialists, you know. They've just got it drilled into their head that the Germans were just also evil. But, you know, you never know. You might be able to win some over at some point. I mean, we got to make a dent somewhere. And I think I got close to halfway through the book on the last show that I did, which, by the way, was on January 8th. Today is February 8th. And or February 9th now. February 9th. Probably should have announced today was the 9th. Started the show midnight my time. And if I get through with it tonight, I'll just stop at that point. And I'm not going to go no more than 2 hours. You know, I'm going to try to put a two-hour limit on it. Unless I just get so close to the end that I may as well finish. That could wind up being the case. And it's hard to tell exactly. You know, there's a bibliography in the back or an index or something. And all of this is footnoted, of course. And it's all taken from multiple sources. And again, a reminder, this is not positive towards National Socialism in any way. They use the term Nazi, not National Socialist. I don't put it past these people as well to slightly embellish, you know, to drive their point home. I mean, after all, the intention of this book is to keep them from looking any further. And so the more embellishment, the better. But it does clearly indicate or say or spell out or tell or whatever word you want to use what they actually did. And then when I'm done with this, and this will be on another show, part of another show, I will give out the information that I have from the Allied Intelligence Services that indicate what they were doing. And that will probably conclude this. And if anybody still doesn't get it afterwards, then they're beyond reaching. So what I'm going to do next here is I'm going to play a short song, and I'll be right back, and I'll start into the book when I get back. And this one is not an Elton John song, but the rest of the show will be. So anyway, I will return in just a second.
You've never had a word.
Okay, before I actually get started here, let me say a couple more things. You know, it's been kind of hard lately for me to schedule shows in, and sometimes I think I'm going to do a show, and, you know, I hesitate about posting it because so many things just keep coming up, and it's like I just hate posting shows and then having to put on their date and time subject to change, you know, but every once in a while you just got to do that. However, when I've done that, it sure seems like the live audience was bigger. It's like once it's posted and it sits there for a while, then enough more people see it and catch it live versus just in the archive. But we'll see, you know. And then I've had to switch gears. You know, I mentioned that I was trying to avoid doing that, but, you know, you got to do it sometimes. And like I said earlier, you know, I run across something and it gives me a reason to switch. And I'm going to also be doing more of these audio portions of documentaries as well, so expect some of those. And expect some part twos coming up of some of what I did at the end of December and first part of January. And there will be continuing parts that will lead to some part of a show or all of a show on a particular topic, even if it's been just solely from a documentary. And some of the people who are following me on Facebook will get to hear in a show some of the stuff that they've seen me posting there. And so with that said, let's one more thing. I'm not sure how many breaks I'm going to take from reading tonight. You know, when I take a break and then I come back, you know, my voice has had a little bit of a rest and it sounds better. You know, I've listened to some of my shows after doing them, and I can tell when my voice starts to strain, and then, you know, I'll play a song, and just, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, you know, that's enough to change the way my voice sounds. So we'll see. And that being the case, I may actually play something else besides Elton John. So anyway, I'm going to pick up where I left off on the last show that I of this topic. Nazis tried to hide their persecution of Christians because it would complicate their relationships with other nations. Nevertheless, when the pastor of the American church in Berlin was invited to a Nazi party luncheon in 1936, he came with the understanding that he could say a prayer. He relates the following. Everyone looked somewhat startled when it was announced that grace would be said. Apparently, they were even more startled at the nature of that little prayer, which obtained a temporary niche in history when Louis Lochner sent an account of it to New York as the first Christian prayers offered at an official Nazi function. It was probably the last. And again, this particular chapter, all through the book, but in this particular chapter, if I remember correctly, he quotes different authors, so keep that in mind. In another book, Herman, one of these authors that he's quoting from, wrote, on April 17, 1936, Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, forbade any party official to occupy a church position. In June, the sale of the Bible and the rental of rooms for religious purposes was stopped. The Reich Minister of Education, Rust, prohibited university students from taking sides in the confessional struggle. Leading personages in the party and state left the church in increasing numbers. It was no longer a secret that the party exercised strong pressure on all its members, especially on the state employees and members of the SS, the police, and the youth organizations, which now belonged completely to the state. And I'm going to interject something here. Yes. It was basically to the level of forbidden in the SS. Okay, back to the book. Everyone who desired to get a good position was obliged to resign from the church. By July 1936, a manifesto was read in thousands of churches in Germany which said, things have come to such a pass that the honor of German citizens is being dragged through the mud because they are Christians. The Christian population of Germany, note, with strong emotion and indignation that they were jeered at and mocked at in every way, through the press, the theater, lectures, mass meetings, etc., because of their faith in Jesus Christ. And the question is asked whether they are reliable. Those who firmly cling to the gospel are especially suspected in these respects. This was the sort of argument which was regularly waged against German Jews as well. German Jews who had proved themselves in the First War, who professed their patriotism in every way, even who had originally supported Hitler, all were forever suspect because of their being Jewish. It was exactly the same thing with Christians, except that Christians who renounced Christianity and embraced Nazi paganism were safe. By this time, even collections to help the families of pastors who had been sent to prison or concentration camps were forbidden, and the Gestapo seized any money collected for that purpose. On November 4th, 1936, the Nazis ordered the removal of crucifixes from schools in the Oldenburg area on the grounds that these were symbols of superstition. This order was rescinded only after Nazis were faced with determined local opposition. Then, in what would become a typical practice, despite rescinding the Nazi prohibition of these symbols of superstition, in December 1936, Nazi bureaucrats simply removed crucifixes anyway in Munsterland. When Christians replaced them in some schools, they were arrested by the Nazis. By 1937, the level of persecution was such that both Catholics and Protestants resisted totalitarian control, and both these groups were violently repressed. In June 1937, the Prussian courts ruled that they could not protect either of them against secret police interference. The clergy of both denominations were threatened with prosecution for treason if they sought foreign sympathy. A deputy Nazi party leader barred both Protestants and Catholics from membership. The same year, Hermann wrote, "Cold-bloodedly, the government went on issuing decrees and making arrests until virtually the whole leadership of the confessional church was put behind bars as common criminals," and Black, describing the same oppression, wrote, "During April, May, and June, arrest followed arrest. The Gestapo broke into houses, stole documents, impounded pastors. By the end of October, it is estimated, and the exact figures are hard to find, that 500 pastors had been arrested. When the confessional church openly decreed the tenets of the German Christians, this was too much. The state struck. 700 pastors, including Pastor Niemöller, were arrested, and 5,000 others received visits from the Gestapo telling them exactly where they and the state stood. After this, prayers were offered up in the churches for those pastors who were still in Gaol, G-A-O-L. For the first time, congregations learned that their pastors were being introduced to the rigors of the concentration camp. By December 1937, a memorandum issued by the Protestant chaplains in the German army stated, "The new breach, which divides the German people, it says, is the breach between National Socialism and Christianity. This fact is repeatedly denied. It is true nonetheless. In the training camps of the party, it is repeatedly explained that National Socialism has three enemies: Judaism, Masonry, and Christianity." And I'm going to interject here. They shut down all of the lodges except for the Thule Society, as all of the other lodges were infested with Judaism. And, of course, the Thule Society, which was an occult society, was the ones who created the Third Reich and the National Socialist Party and put Hitler into place. So all of you Christians out there, try to explain away the Thule Society, and that's spelled T-H-U-L-E. Some people say Thule, but I've heard people who speak German call it Thule. Back to the book. Let's see here. Public acceptance of Christianity is regarded when a new position is filled as a tie that unfits the candidate for service to the state or party. The means by which this combat is carried on is the ruthless use of state power. The racial ethic represented through the party and the police, armed with all the force of the totalitarian state, hurls itself against materially helpless Christianity. The situation has become wholly intolerable through the fashion of which state forces are employed. In Hall, H-A-L-L-E, a high functionary of the stormtroops referred to Christ as that swine. School teachers have repeatedly referred to Jesus in their classrooms as that Jewish tramp. Now, keep in mind, young people, that at this time, tramp had a little bit different meaning than it does today. Today, a tramp is basically like a female street whore. Back then, a tramp was just like a bum on the street. So, you know, sometimes words change meanings and they shouldn't. And sometimes slang changes meanings, which doesn't matter if it's slang anyway, I guess. But back to the book. And by the way, I think the Jewish tramp or being a bum was actually pretty accurate description there. Back to the book. By 1938, things have gotten so bad that Duncan Jones wrote, "No effort has been spared to render the confessional movement impotent. Its colleges have been suppressed. Its funds have been seized. Its leaders have been imprisoned over and over again. In the early part of 1938, an attempt was made to sterilize its leadership by orders forbidding the members of the Provisional Church Administration to meet. At the time of writing, the confessional movement is severely smitten, but it carries on, not knowing what may be in store for it, not expecting earthly success, and yet prepared to suffer all that must come, because its strength is not of this world. The resistance of the confessionals is one of the many great vindications of the indomitable power of conscience that history affords." And I want to interject again, just a reminder that the author claims that some of the stuff that he quotes from was taken from books that was written pre-World War II or during World War II. So, as I read here in this last paragraph, when it referred to at this time, you can understand that it was at the time of the National Socialists in power. I'm just reminding everybody of that. Back to the book. Preaching from the pulpit against Rosenberg's racial theories was forbidden by the Nazis in law number 130, threatened penalties against any priest who preached against the interests of the state. By September 1938, Rosenberg was able to say, "There are hotheads among us who would like to compel the Führer to simply root out the Catholic and Protestant churches, just as we have the Bolshevik Party. But we must remember that the international position of the Catholic Church calls for very careful tactics on our part toward that church, that the Catholic Church and also the confessional church in their present form must disappear from the life of the people is my full conviction, and I believe I'm entitled to say that this is also our Führer's viewpoint." And I'll interject here. It's my understanding that they actually infiltrated the Vatican. I mean, you know, many of you have seen photos of Hitler, you know, meeting with the Pope or cardinals or whatever. And, you know, it's politics. You know, I mean, unless they intended to just shut the Vatican down, I mean, how would that look to the world had they done that? And, of course, that was in Italy, not Germany. So, nevertheless, William Harmon Black wrote about the months that followed While realizing the impossibility of coordinating the Catholic Church with the Nazi regime, the Nazis followed a policy of restricting Catholic activities, of discrediting the Church with the German people, and of extending their control over Catholic youth. And orders from Berlin then forbade opposition pastors to speak in public, placed their churches under lock and key, and caused the arrest of Bishop Wurm, W-U-R-M, and many of his followers. Meanwhile, Mueller toured Wurttemberg, speaking chiefly at gatherings recruited by the SA, and asserting categorically that the Church would either embrace National Socialism or cease to be. Half the members of the monasteries had been arrested by 1938. By 1938, religious radio broadcasts were completely banned, and 2 years later, after that, religious publications were banned as well, allegedly on the grounds of paper shortages. And my thoughts are, well, once you prove a religion to be bogus, it's not a religion anymore, is it? You know, that's what I have to stress to people when I'm arguing about the First Amendment in this country all the time. Claim you got religious freedom. Well, how is it a religion? You know, it's been proven bullshit. So anyway, I've discussed some of that on other shows. By 1938, Dark in Essex wrote, "It has been forbidden to have collecting boxes in church rooms or even in evangelical homes." The publication of church news has been much curtailed by legislation, which enacts that all editors must be members of the National Press Association, which requires that its members shall be ready to answer accusations against political reliability. If their explanation is not considered satisfactory, they are expelled from the association, and this means that they can carry on their work no longer. Church papers, parish magazines, and other church literature have been brought to a complete standstill. There was an attempt soon after these regulations were introduced to institute a new service by means of duplicating machines, but as soon as this scheme was made known, the duplicators were confiscated. The steadily increasing persecution of Christianity and Christians ratcheted up each month and each year, much like the Nazi persecution of Jews. It became more and more difficult to be a Christian in Nazi Germany. Describing the 1938 takeover of Austria by the Nazis, Power writes, "All over Austria, men and women have lost their jobs for professing openly their faith. The party has never attempted to conceal the fact that only its own members stand a good chance of obtaining the best positions in civil employment. Sometimes there has even been a drive against Catholics in a business, and all those who refuse to sign the form by which they are given the chance to deny the church dismissed. In one of the great Vienna hospitals where Catholic nursing sisters have worked for years, the entire staff was thrown out and their places taken over by National Socialist Brown Sisters. When the Nazis occupied Austria, they seized the monasteries and convents, sending those nuns and monks who did not escape to concentration camps. By 1939, Lichtenberger was writing, "In a reply to what they consider to be provocations, the National Socialists have multiplied the trials for abuse of the pulpit. They have muzzled the Catholic press, censored or stopped bishop letters, even suspending the little weekly or diocesan, D-I-O-C-E-S-A-N, religious bulletins. In the Catholic world, information has come to depend on typewritten sheets which circulate undercover or on oral communication by trusted emissaries." The same year, Pierre Van Passen wrote in his book called Days of Our Lives that Germany is farther on the road to de-Christianization than the Soviet Union, and that in place of God, Nazis have placed the almighty state, which demands everything from man. The same year, Ernst Humblock wrote that because the Roman Catholic Church has been opposing the Nazis as pagan, the Nazis accused the Vatican of being in league with communism. Fairly accurate accusation, if you ask me, even though they claimed the total opposite. Let me clear my throat. By a decree of October 31st, 1940, all clergymen had to sign in with the local police office. Christian clergy were also conscripted into military service, not as clergy, but as frontline soldiers, and they were deliberately sent to the front lines of battle where the mortality rate was the highest. Makes sense to me. The Nazi newspaper Das Schwarze Korps wrote that the German soldiers did not want to be blessed by priests, those wretched creatures of dirt and fire, those representatives of pious cowardice. Fodor, who personally knew Russian Bolsheviks and followed closely the Bolshevik Revolution as well as the National Socialist Revolution and the fascist regime, noted in his 1940 book that the Nazis surpassed all other totalitarian systems in its persecution of churches, finding even the Soviet Union less hateful toward Christianity than the Nazis, who persecuted not only Christians, but Christianity itself. And if you've been listening to any of these shows that I have been posting lately, then you should fully understand why. Churches were not allowed to collect funds for charitable work. The Nazis transferred Catholic clergy to Protestant areas and Protestant clergy to Catholic areas. Nazis smeared excrement on church altars and church doors, desecrated shrines, and threw statues of saints into dung piles. And when synagogues were not available to attack and loot, churches were often the target, with Nazis yelling, "Down with Christians and Jews." Now, that to me does not sound like something that would actually have happened. I mean, that just sounds ridiculous. Smearing feces? No, I don't think so. In many places, historic church feast days and holidays were banned, and even the display of religious flags and banners was outlawed. Often Nazis cordoned off areas necessary for church pilgrimages and offered free beer and sausages for secular events that deliberately coincided with church festivals. Hey, sounds like fun to me. Nazi hatred of Christianity led to the Nazis ruthlessly removing Christianity from public life. Films are likewise scrupulously irreligious. Even the Spanish film called Alcazar, which glorified the Franco cause, was censored and purged of every reference to prayer or faith or God. And Hermann, who lived 6 years in Nazi Germany, observed, "In all my 6 years in Germany, I never saw an impartial, to say nothing of favorable, article on Christianity, unless the annual notice that church taxes were due might be considered impartial." Censorship and thought control in Nazi Germany did not even allow a favorable word about Christianity during the 6 years in which Hermann was in Berlin. Films had pious allusions to Christianity removed. The pattern was clear. Nazis were intent on assiduously purging German society of the very idea of Christianity. Black commented on the overall pattern of Nazi actions. I'm sorry. "It is apparent on all sides that since his rise to power, there has been a persistent and deliberate effort to de-Christianize Germany. And in this process, both Catholics and Protestants have been attacked and victimized by the Reich." Let me clear my throat. Hold on. Okay, which been attacked and victimized by the Reich, which offered as a substitute for Christianity the neo-paganism of present-day Germany. And again, neo? Right. Wythe, W-Y-T-H-E, wrote in 1941 that Although not many anti-religious books and pamphlets have been printed by the Nazis since September 1939, previously issued literature continues to be plentiful. It is distributed among soldiers and civilians as before. There are brochures of Rudolf Hammer published in Munich quoting a certain renegade, Pastor Alfred Bonn, to the effect that Jesus was begot in blood shame and that his mother was a woman of easy virtue. And they put in parentheses here, a stronger word is used. See, that tells you the target audience when they won't even give the quote precisely what it is because it's considered vulgar. How marginalized had Christians become in Nazi Germany? Consider that by 1941, all religious education was banned from schools. Bands were even forbidden to play chorale music, C-H-O-R-A-L-E. I guess I said that right. And even more pastoral care in hospitals was being made more and more difficult. Hotels or hospices run by Christian organizations were told to remove all religious pictures from the rooms and Bibles from the bedside tables. In June 1941, it was about this time that pastors were refused admittance to hospitals and clinics unless they came at the written invitation of a patient and with the approval of medical authorities. In such cases, they were forbidden to visit or speak to any other invalid. In his 1941 book called Pattern of Conquest, Joseph Harsh wrote that Nazism was profoundly anti-Christian and hostile to Western civilization as well. In 1941, Lowenstein wrote that the Nazis were not content to simply subjugate the churches, but to de-Christianize religion altogether and to root out Jewish Christian morality. Albert Parry notes in his 1941 book called Riddle of the Reich that not a single pastoral letter had been permitted by the Nazi government to be read from the pulpit for three preceding years, and that this ban included even the Pope's encyclicals. Parry goes on to note that Pope Pius XI had protested Nazism, and the Nazi obituary for Pius XI said that he had began as a pope, but ended as a political adventurer. It went on to say that in the next pope, Pope Pius XII, the German government hoped to find a more pliable personality, but the hope was not fulfilled. In the 1943 book called Christian Counterattack, Europe's Churches Against Nazism, observes, beyond all question, the Nazis are waging war upon the Christian faith and Christian values and the uniqueness of Christian opposition to the Nazis. While in Germany, the political parties, the law, the universities, the press, the trade unions capitulated, the first check to the triumphant onward march of Nazism was given by a small, resolute body of Christian men, the Confessional Church. The same year, Clara Eastlake wrote, as Germany sees victory slipping from her grasp, she has reinforced the power of the Gestapo and increased the torture, slaughter, and wholesale massacre of Christians as well as Jews in her midst. The Nazis entered their reign hostile to Christianity, and although they sometimes tried to mask that animus from the outside world for political reasons, this hatred became real persecution almost as soon as Hitler came to power. Although those who maliciously intend to somehow weave the threads of Christianity through the evil of Nazism may find, here and there, exceptions to the rule, anyone can always find exceptions to the rule. Consider that thoughtful critics of Nazism at the time were universal in their general perception. Nazis hated Christianity. persecuted Christianity, and considered Christianity in many ways the greatest enemy of Nazism. This chapter covers only the general persecution of Christianity. Perhaps more telling was the war that the Nazis waged upon Christian education of the young. What happened to Christian clergymen was, in some ways, irrelevant to Nazis. Drown a couple of generations in loathing for Judeo-Christianity. The Judeo part was easy from the venom reserved for Nazis against Jews. Less so, but critically more important, was the Nazi venom spent on Christians. Now, this next chapter is called The Nazi War on Christian Education. The Nazis conducted a systematic effort to keep children from learning or practicing Christianity, as Hermann saw while he was in Germany. Children were encouraged to abandon the religious classes, and teachers were prohibited from continuing the lessons. Only clergymen were allowed to teach religion, whereby a further reduction of the number of classes became inevitable. When Wurttemberg clergymen refused to teach religion according to the illegal instructions of the Ministry of Education, 700 clergymen were banned from classes. Let me clear my throat real quick. Okay. This arbitrary measure was founded on the assertion that these resisting clergymen had violated the oath sworn to Hitler. The lessons of religion were entirely suppressed in many districts. Also, Christian prayers were abolished in schools, and crucifixes were removed from rooms. It was not so much that religion was banned in German schools as it was that Christianity was banned in German schools. The Nazi war on Christian education moved at least as fast as the Nazi war on Christian churches. By 1935, it had reached the point, according to Schuster, that Catholic parents viewed with profound alarm the virtual segregation of their children. Statements that henceforth the civil service would be recruited solely from those who had belonged to the Hitlerjugend were followed by other equally discriminatory pronouncements. And, in order to make the situation more difficult still, Balder von Schirach issued a regulation prohibiting simultaneous membership in both Catholic and Nazi organizations. Various business enterprises in quest of government contracts then also began to discriminate against youthful employees not identified with Hitler groups. The Nazi efforts were not just directed against Christian education, but also against parents and students who sought Christian education. Preventing civil service advancement to young people who had Christian instruction and pressuring businesses not to hire young people who had Christian instruction was a sort of bigotry toward Christianity which did not occur outside the Soviet Union. The same year, 1935, the Nazis attacked Christian schools themselves as power states. These placards on walls, on houses, and telegraph poles proclaimed, "One people, one Reich, one Führer, one community school. He who sends his child to the denominational school wrongs his child and interferes with the unity of our people. We do not want our evangelical schools. We want the school of Adolf Hitler." The harassment of Christian youth, particularly Catholic youth, was appalling. During the same year, 1935, Power also tells of the mistreatment of Catholic youth in a particular incident. The length to which the state was prepared to go is best shown by the case of the 2,000 Catholic boys who paid a visit to the Holy Father in Rome at Easter 1935. On their return from the audience, which they were granted, they were set upon at the frontier at Constance by the secret police. I guess Constance is a geographic location. Their cameras, rucksacks, rosaries, musical instruments, souvenirs of Rome, everything they had with them was confiscated. Their shirts were torn off their backs. They did not see their belongings again. The same year, Catholic girls went out on excursion in Weiden in the Oberplatz, where were attacked by Hitler Youth, thrown to the ground, and beaten black and blue. The same year, Holtz, an adjutant to Julius Streicher, said at Nuremberg, "Instead of running to church with your mothers, you ought to stay at home and prepare food for your fathers. And when somebody will send you boys to divine services, you had better play football." Now, I do know one thing. Julius Streicher had written some things in some of his writings, and I'm interjecting this, that were certainly Christian. Now, I do not know if they simply tolerated him being Christian or if that was in an earlier stage when after Hitler had taken power and they had not begun a full persecution or what. I would have to look into that further to find out. But it is my understanding that Julius Streicher was a Christian, at least in the beginning. Maybe that changed. Let's see here. Where was I at? Okay, I'm just going to repeat the Julius Streicher thing. It says, the same year, Holtz, an adjutant to Julius Streicher, said at Nuremberg, "Instead of running to church with your mothers, you ought to stay at home and prepare food for your fathers. And when somebody will send you boys to divine service, you had better play football." To you Americans, that would be soccer. Schuster writes of the end of 1935 on December 8th. He, referring to Mueller, startled Germany by arbitrarily declaring that henceforth the evangelical youth groups would be incorporated into the Hitlerjugend. This was an exceedingly sore point with the opposition because Baldur von Schirach, leader of the Hitlerjugend, was an outspoken pagan who declared that belief in Germany must take precedence over allegiance to any church. In fact, as part of the initiation into the Hitler Youth, boys were required to state, "German blood and Christian baptismal water are completely irreconcilable." Let me clear my throat again. By 1936, the situation grew worse for those who wanted their children to be involved in Christian youth activities. In 1936, further encroachments were made by the Hitler Youth on the Catholic organizations. Youth members were forbidden to wear XP badges and bands, uniforms and flags, prohibited for public processions or group formation. Himmler banned all confessing church seminaries and instruction in 1937, and he closed all private religious schools 2 years later. Parents and children were made hostage to poverty if children received a Christian education, and Power writes that it was made clear over and over again that to vote for the confessional school was to vote treacherously and against the New Germany and against the express wishes of the Fuhrer himself. More important still to parents of large and often poor families, it was made increasingly clear that only children at the community school enjoyed the best changes of work when their education was complete. The Nazis intimidated people by whatever devices they had to reject a Christian education. I'm going to read one more paragraph, and then I'm going to play a song and give my voice a little break. It says, what happened when children entered the Hitler Youth? Did this Nazi organization accept Christianity? Was it indifferent toward Christianity, or was it hostile to Christianity? Consider the inscription over the clinic at the Hitler Youth Center at Halle, H-A-L-L-E. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It reads, the faith fanatics who still today slide down on their knees with faces uplifted to heaven, waste their time in church going and prayers, and have not yet understood that they are living on the earth and that therefore their task is of a thoroughly earthly kind. All we Hitler people can still only look with the greatest contempt on those young people who still run to their silly evangelical or Catholic churches in order to vent their quite superstitious religious feelings. Effectively conscripted into Hitler Youth, we're told that ordinary Christians were faith fanatics and Protestants and Catholics had superstitious religious feelings. The Hitler Youth was intended to pound Christianity out of children. Okay, let me play a song here, and I will be right back.
Muggy night, curtains drawn in the little room downstairs. Prima donna Lord, you really should have been there, sitting like a princess perched in her electric chair. And just one more beer, and I don't.
Okay. William Harmon Black wrote in his book in 1938, "The initial battle is for control of the youth of the country. The Christian churches, on the one hand, desires to maintain its parochial schools, where the young people may grow up with an education based on the morals and the manners of the Christian religion. On the other hand, the German state wants to divorce all religion from the education of its youth. As Hitler himself announced, the state must control all attitude, shaping influences, finally, completely and irrevocably. This was the heart of the matter. Hitler and the Nazis would not allow anything that provided a different message from Nazism. The voice of conscience, which Christian education would give, was incompatible with Christianity. It must be ruthlessly purged." Voice of conscience? Are you kidding me? Yeah, right. In 1939, Lichtenberger commented on the complete isolation of the Catholic Church, of Catholic youth, I'm sorry. "The youth Catholic, faithful to his association, is condemned to lead the solitary life of a semi-pariah, happy when he is not treated by his Nazi comrades as a renegade and traitor to Germanism, and is not insulted and beaten." And he also noted that Nazification of education in those places in Germany, which once had Catholic education, uniformed Nazis had replaced Catholic priests and professors in high schools and Catholic nuns in lower schools and kindergartens. Let me relight the cigarette that won't stay lit. And by the way, I am finally at the point where I had stopped reading, and so pretty much everything from this point on is going to be unread by me previously, so you're getting it when I'm getting it. In 1941, when the Nazi tract called Gott und Volk was distributed, Hermann noted how the Nazis intended children to grow up. It describes how the Nazis would replace Christianity so that students would be able to grow up without ever knowing Christianity. With parties and gifts, the youth will be led painlessly from one faith to the other and will grow up without ever having heard of the Sermon on the Mount or the Golden Rule, to say nothing of the Ten Commandments. This goal was openly proclaimed in a book entitled Gott und Volk, which was distributed in the hundreds of thousands of copies throughout the army in the spring of 1941. In chapter 13, entitled Our Task, there is a paragraph which says, "The education of the youth is to be confined primarily by the teacher, the officer, and the leaders of the party. The priests will die out. They have estranged the youth from the Volk. Into their places will step the leaders, not deputies of God, but anyway, the best Germans. And how shall we train our children? Thus, as though they had never heard of Christianity." Well, like our ancestors before Christianity was forced on them by the sword. In fact, members of German Christian Youth Organization, were required to resign from those even before joining the Hitlerjugend. And as McFarland writes, "Even if double membership were permitted, the Hitler Youth Movement takes up so large an amount of time and has so attractive an appeal that the religious groups would be weakened in allegiance." Well, what does that say to you people? "Moreover, it is claimed that great pressure is brought on the church youth by their friends in the Hitler movement and in schools, by all sorts of propaganda, to unite with that organization." What sort of things did the Hitlerjugend teach about Christianity? Power reports that the lines handed out to Hitler youth teaches, which he saw included, "Christianity is a religion of slaves and fools. How did Christ die? Whining at the cross. The Ten Commandments represent the lowest instincts of man, and Christianity is merely a cloak for Judaism, and I would have to agree. Erica Mann, in her book School for Barbarians, wrote that the fanatical war of National Socialism against the church is fought on so large a field that the contest results only in battles won by one side and then the other, but that the one thing is clear, the stake of the war is the souls of the children. Both sides are battling for the future, and that the remedy proposed by the Nazis to solve the enemy of Christianity was to take Christian children whose parents insisted on teaching them Christian virtues away from their parents, much like the Bolsheviks would take Christian children away from their parents. Duncan Jones said almost exactly the same thing in his book. The school was the sphere where conflict between the Christian faith and the Nazi religion was most acute, because the Nazis were determined at all costs to obtain the possession of the souls of the young. This extended to the war on Christmas, so familiar in America today. When German youths were evacuated by the government, one of the chief grounds of complaint circulated privately, if not presented publicly, was the deliberate attempt to wean Christian children away from their religion. They were told not to say their prayers or ask to go to the local church. When Christmas came, parents were horrified to learn that the children's festivities, while elaborate, were shorn of every Christian symbol. Well, it has nothing to do with that holiday to begin with. In one camp, a few homesick kiddies who gathered in one room the day after Christmas began to sing Silent Night, and some other carols were severely reprimanded for attempting to augment the German Christmas by the introduction of alien customs. Lowenstein, in 1941, wrote that in the Hitler Youth, the neo-pagan cult began to fill the gap, which was the result of a conscious erosion of Christianity. The Nazis even forbade parents to give their children Christian names and ordered babies instead to be given names like Dietrich, Otto, or Siegfried. The home teaching of Christianity by parents in the home was forbidden. Herman noted in his 1943 book, "It remains to be seen whether the faith confessed by the thousands of boys before the Christian altars of Germany or the faith professed by tens of thousands of enthusiastic youngsters in oaths of fidelity to Hitler will prove stronger. There is no longer any doubt that these two faiths exist and that one of them must be destroyed if the other is to exist." The Nazi war on Christian education was something that was constantly mentioned by authors of books about the Third Reich. There was very little doubt either by the actions and words of the Nazis or by the opinions expressed by many authors that the Nazis intended to de-Christianize Germany by isolating the young of Germany from all Christian influence. The next chapter is called The Christian Response to Nazism. Who opposed the Nazis on moral grounds? Who openly resisted the Nazis? The only real opponents that the Nazis had in Germany were Christians. What about the Bolsheviks? Did they not oppose the Nazis? Eugene Lyons, in his masterpiece called The Red Decade, states, in the middle of 1931, upon direct orders from Moscow, the German communists voted with the Nazis against the Prussians and against the Republic. In 1931, the Communist Party of Germany cooperated with the Nazi Party in the Prussian referendum. The next year, as Calvin Hoover notes in his book, Germany Enters the Third Reich, communist and Nazi labor unions joined together to support the general strike of Berlin transportation workers just prior to the November 1932 election, which was a rude shock to conservatives who had assumed that National Socialism meant an end of the labor unions and strikes and the delivery of workers to the mercies of the employer. This need not have been a rude shock. Okay, I see where this is going. They're going to continue to sit here and try to connect Nazism and communism as one and the same. We'll see how much of this is real and how much of this is propaganda. Nazi and communist labor unions often collaborated in strikes, and by 1931, 2 years before Hitler was made Chancellor of Germany, Nazi labor unions had more members than communist labor unions. In 1934, while still only in power a short time, Hitler told Hermann Rauschning, the Nazi leader of Danzig, that National Socialism is what Marxism might have been if it could have broken its absurd and artificial ties with a democratic order. Let me interject something here. And in case some of you don't know, when National Socialist Party was still trying to achieve some success, it basically split in the parliament between the communists, the conservatives, and the National Socialists as far as percentages. It was pretty equal. And usually the conservatives and the National Socialists, in order to defeat the communists, would vote together. And this is before the National Socialist Party had actually come into power. So just keep that in mind. And Hitler was, I think, made chancellor on January 1933. I think it was 33. Yeah, 33. It was the same month and year as Roosevelt on his reelection. And the American election would have been in 32, and Roosevelt would have taken office in 33. And I don't think they had changed the inauguration date from March to January at that time. And I think that was actually, I'm sorry, I spoke wrong. That was the first time president had taken office in the United States in January, whereas to that point it had always been in March. And I will go into that astrologically one day. I have mentioned it previously if you've caught any of my shows on it. So, 33 would have been, January 33 would be the point where the National Socialists actually began to really start to take power. And even then, it wasn't until Hindenburg passed away that Hitler was able to acquire both the presidency and the chancellorship. And I think that was within a year of Hitler becoming the chancellor. Large numbers of German communists joined the Nazi Party before it came to power. There were some, yes, I do know that for a fact. In fact, many communists on orders from Moscow joined the Nazi Party and rose to highest positions within the Nazi Party and worked with zeal as Nazis long before the Nazis gained power. German communists even joined the Nazi Party after Hitler came to power. How did Nazis view non-Jewish German communists? In his 1936 book, Government in the Third Reich, Morstein Marx states that National Socialist attorneys were prohibited from accepting cases from Jews, but told to never refuse a case from any non-Jew communists because communists were merely misled. Jan Valtain, in his 1942 book, Out of the Night, describes his career as one of the most important communists in Germany. The book, published in America while the Soviet Union was an ally of America, described his torture by the Nazis and his complete disillusionment with Bolshevism. It describes in detail the direct collaboration between the Nazi Party and the Communist Party in the 1930s. Yes, there was a collaboration because Hitler made a deal with Stalin in order to make sure that there was not a two-front war. And they also needed, raw materials that the Soviet Union could provide. And Stalin viewed it as a way to just control try to control Hitler's. So he went along with it. I'm sure there were other details involved as to the motivation. That's just off the top of my head. So keep in mind here, when I read about collaboration between the communists and the National Socialists, there was a period of time, and it was determined that by the Reich that they had to put an end to the Bolshevik menace, and they also had discovered that Stalin had been massing troops in offensive positions in order to invade Europe. And so it became pretty clear at a certain point that they had to abandon any cooperation with them, and they surprise attacked them. So this author, though, is going to sit here and make every conjecture that these two were cooperating with the same intentions, and I do not believe that is to be the case. However, there may be incidents of common goals. So, large numbers of German communists joined the okay, I think I already read that. Yes, I did. Okay. Out of the Night describes his career as one of the most important communists in Germany. The book published in America while the Soviet Union was an ally of America describes his torture. I've already read that. It describes in direct collaboration, the direct collaboration between the Nazi Party and Communist Party in the 1930s. There we go. The communists, for example, sent a courier to the Nazi Party in the spring of 1932 asking the Nazis to collaborate with them in breaking up the Transport Workers Union Conference, and the two groups, Nazis and communists, did just that. On another occasion, the Nazis sent a request to the Communist Party to disrupt Social Democrats, and the communists obliged, sitting side by side with the Nazis in the front row before interrupting Paul von Lettow Vorbeck, yelling obscenities, throwing stink bombs, and itching power, and releasing a large number of white mice into the crowds. Georgi, G-E-O-R-G-I, I guess that's how you say it, Dimitrov, Bulgarian Secretary General of Comintern, even ordered communists to vote with the Nazis to oust the Social Democratic Party in Prussia, which the communists did. Vyacheslav Molotov, addressing the Supreme Soviet on October 31st, 1939, said that it was criminal to wage a war against Hitlerism disguised as a fight for the democracies. The Non-Aggression Pact of August 23, 1939 was not the only agreement signed between the Nazis and the Soviets. They signed the Treaty of Friendship on September 28, 1939. They signed a Comprehensive Trade Agreement on February 11, 1940, and they signed a Supplementary Trade Agreement on January 10, 1941. Once the Second World War in Europe actually began, all the communist parties in Europe blamed Britain and France for starting the war and said Germany wanted peace. And the Germany did want peace. I did a huge portion of a show on that. The French government banned the Communist Party because of his disloyalty to France in the war with Germany. French communists opposed rearmament even though France was at war. Marxist renegade Louis Fischer in 1940 observed that the Bolsheviks and the Nazis were doing everything possible to avoid acts which displeased the other. They actually began defending what the other was doing. Bolsheviks did not merely justify their deeds in Poland, but they defended what the Nazis were doing in Poland as well. Izvestia on October 9, 1939 stated, "The government of the Soviet Union and the government of Germany undertook the task of establishing peace and order on the territory of the former Poland and to give to the peoples inhabiting that territory a peaceful existence which would correspond to their national characteristics. After the Second World War began, until the German army invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941, Bolsheviks were enthusiastic supporters of the Nazis, and the Nazis were very careful to say nothing offensive about the Bolsheviks. What about the other institutions in Germany that might have opposed the Nazis? All of them were completely compromised. Academia was the most easily seduced part of German culture. Martin Heidegger, perhaps the most influential philosopher of the 20th century, joined the Nazi Party and maintained a strong allegiance to the party, serving as one of its leading intellectuals. After the Second World War, Heidegger was defended by leftists for active support for the Nazi reign. In 1936, Nazi racial theorist Alfred Ploetz, Ploetz, was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in racial hygiene. Konrad Lorenz, the brilliant behavioral psychologist whose theory of imprinting was demonstrated while he convinced ducklings that he was their mother and whose work is profoundly influential today, was, like Heidegger, not simply a camp following of Nazism and Hitler, but an enthusiastic supporter of Nazism and Adolf Hitler. University students were particularly susceptible to Nazism, and by 1930, 3 years before the Nazis gained power, the National Socialist Student Association, or NSDSTD, was the most popular student association on the college campuses of Germany. These were the very college campuses that were turning out the world's leading physicists and the world's most respected philosophers and intellectuals of every stripe. The only people who openly opposed the Nazis and who continued to oppose the Nazis were serious Christians. When the eight bishops of Bavaria met in February 1931, they said, "The church must conclude that what National Socialism calls Christianity is not the Christianity of Christ." These bishops issued a declaration that protested against Nazi racial policies and forbade priests to give the sacraments to any members of the Nazi Party. Well, of course they would. They would certainly oppose the racial policies. Christianity is communist. Otto Delibius, the general superintendent of the Mark of Brandenburg, in early 1933, responded to Nazi hate by stating, "We are united in affirming that the gospel stands in opposition to all human ideology, whether nationalist or socialist." In December of that year, Catholic Cardinal Faulhaber specifically called upon Protestants and Catholics to make common cause in defense of Christianity and against the paganism of the Nazis. Soon thereafter, the Pastors' Emergency Federation was proclaiming about the Nazi bishop, "He has tried to muzzle us, but we refuse to be muzzled." In his 1934 book, The New Church and the New Germany, Charles McFarland, writing less than a year after Hitler took power and having interviewed Hitler himself, wrote, "National Socialism in Germany discovered little difficulty in its complete transformation of the life and even the mind of the nation until it struck the Protestant Christian Church, or more particularly, the pastors of those churches. At this point, it has aroused a near counter-revolution in which, unless the state is cautious, as at last accounts it appears to be, it may meet its Waterloo by arousing to resistance not a few of the people in general who have thus far accepted it as inescapable, but with reservation or resentment." And later he writes, "It might also be said that the National Socialist leaders have found and will find that the Christian Church is an embarrassment. It cannot be fashioned as readily as our cultural institutions. They will find men whose convictions in their sphere are as unyielding as those of Hitler himself in the political realm. They have to be reckoned with." Confessional Christians, non-Nazi Protestants, rather, opposed the Nazis very early indeed, Okay, I'm going to re-say that. Confessional Christians, parentheses, non-Nazi Protestants, close parentheses, opposed the Nazis very early indeed. By October 1934, the Confessional Synod began publicly comparing the Nazi religious leadership to Satan. Well, there you have it. By the end of that year, as Lichtenberger writes, the increase in the opposition movement was very great. At the end of 1934, it was estimated that out of 16,000 pastors, there were scarcely 3,000 who had ranged themselves freely behind the banner of Bishop Mueller, who was the Nazi bishop, while 13,000 or more were won to the ranks of the confessional front or else observed an attitude of prudent expectancy. Power, in his book on religion in the Reich, relates, at Witzsundai, 1936, the confessional leader sent Hitler himself a secret memorandum which asked, in effect, do you or do you not want to de-Christianize the church? Huh? The memorandum made it plain that promise had not been kept. Was this with the connivance of the party or in spite of it? Why the church was never allowed to answer publicly the accusations made against it? How far do the National Socialists, Weltanschauung, impinge upon the Christianity of the gospel? Justice, concentration camps, the creed of blood and soil, the activities of the Gestapo, all the vexed questions of the past years were raised and clearly put. In this document, the Evangelical Church gave the Führer a clear-cut opportunity to define once and for all, if he could, his attitude toward organized Christianity. There was no answer. The rebellious Protestants of Germany took the great risk of asking straight questions for Hitler, and he simply ignored them. Well, why the hell would he need to feel he had to respond to them? Hermann wrote about the resistance that Christians gave to Hitler. Until the outbreak of the war, and even there afterwards, the church story was one of the biggest features of the news from Germany. All in all, it constituted the only significant and persistent resistance to Adolf Hitler during a dozen incredible years of mass hysteria, ruthless tyranny, and insatiate aggression. This was the greatest domestic failure of the Nazis. The German Führer's colossal failures outweigh in every instance his colossal coups. His biggest failure inside the Reich was the failure to win the church. His most numerous, most vigorous, and most persistent opponents from the first were men and women whose life and work were guided by the gospel. So that seems pretty obvious to me there. Distinguished Jewish professors of college textbooks like Salwin Shapiro, in his 1940 book called Modern and Contemporary European History, wrote, the new bishop believed in the principles of German Christianity and proceeded to Nazify the church by revising the Bible to harmonize with Germanization and by insisting on the Aryan paragraph, a regulation which demanded the elimination from the ministry of anyone of Jewish origin. Many Lutheran ministers refused to accept these changes on the ground that they were contrary to the principles of Christianity. A struggle followed between the government and the ministers, as a result of which many were ousted from their positions and persecuted. The problem of coordinating the Catholic Church was far more difficult because the Nazis had come to terms with the Pope. A concordat was signed between Germany and the Vatican, according to which the church was granted freedom in religious matters. However, conflict arose between the Nazis and the Catholics because the former violated the concordat. Catholic priests were attacked by stormtroops, Catholic newspapers were suppressed, and Catholic schools were closed. In their ruthless policy of coordination, the Nazis encountered only one opposition, that of the Protestant and Catholic clergymen who bravely upheld their principles despite persecution. Professor Lichtenberger, in his 1939 book called The Third Reich, writes, in March 1935, the Confessional Synod of the Evangelical Church held at Dahlem, D-A-H-L-E-M, solemnly accused National Socialism of setting up the myth of race and people, of making idols out of blood and race, nation, honor, and liberty in the place of God, and of demanding as a new religion faith in the eternal Germany, and of wishing to supplant by this new faith in the eternal realm of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Lichtenberg goes on to explain how the confessional church has done it that it could to oppose the Nazis. I guess that makes sense. The confessional Protestants defend themselves as best they can against the seizure, referring to power over religion by the state. They reject as unholy the corrections which the Nazis had made in traditional Christianity. They insist that Wotanized Christianity is no longer Christianity, and that German Christians, in rallying without reservation to the racialist doctrine, had banished themselves from the community of the faithful. Finally, they refuse obedience to the ecclesiastical superiors who do not, in their eyes, represent the community of the faithful, but who were imposed from without the church by political authorities. This extended to the only sorts of opposition that the Christians in Germany could give. The German army, for the first time in its history, has marched into war without the blessing of the German church. Of course, the benediction of all the pastors and priests goes along with the boys who leave for the front, and sincere prayers are prayers for the security from harm and a safe return to their homes, both in spite of formal petition for God's leadership of the leader. What most Christian hearts are really asking God for is not a Nazi triumph, but the miracle of a decent peace from enemies both within and without. Schuster notes in his 1935 book called All That Can Be Said is that nearly all of the pastors, as well as their loyal congregations, did their duty. The spectacle was so reassuring that thoughtful persons everywhere took heart and felt that the lifeblood of civilization still coursed in the veins of the German people. In New York, Dr. Alvin Johnson, who cannot well be accused of enthusiastic support for Christian churches, told a distinguished gathering that the ideal of freedom could be saved from mankind only by those who deceived strongly enough in religion to be willing to die for it. Did I read that right? Told a distinguished gathering that the ideal of freedom could be saved from mankind only by those who believed strongly enough in religion to be willing to die for it. Power wrote, in the Christianity of the German people, the National Socialist has so far found that one enemy that it cannot vanquish. In 1938, Tabuis, wrote in, I guess, a book, Blackmail or War. Only a few brief references can here be made to the underground struggle against the Hitler regime. The extent of the Catholic opposition is being revealed more and more clearly in the sermons which are being preached from the pulpit, and also in the increasing number of people who take part in religious processions. In the summer of 1937, no less than 100,000 paraded at Annaberg in Silesia, while at Aix-la-Chapelle, 50,000 residents resisted all the efforts of the police to disperse them. The Protestant opposition is equally staunch in spite of wholesale arrests of clergy by the agents of the Gestapo. At the present time, 86 pastors of the confessional church are in German prisons, including one of the most popular of them, a pastor, Nehem Mueller of Dahlem, who during the war was the commander of a submarine. In his 1938 book called Germany Puts the Clock Back, Mueller describes how in 1933 freedom vanished and how resistance to Nazis did not come from the universities or science or art or literature or radio or newspapers, but only from religiously serious people. Leo Stein, in his 1942 book called I Was in Hell with Nehem Mueller, says that he is writing the book in spite of the harm that might come to Nehem Mueller because, whether it will result in greater hardships for him or not, I know that it is his wish that the world at large, and especially the people of America, should be enlightened as to the part he has played against the Nazi attempt to destroy Christianity throughout the world. And later in the book he writes, I could not but marvel at the spiritual strength of the man who, as I have said, could have uttered one word of surrender and gained his freedom and probably a high place in the councils of the Nazi Party. Max Dymont observed that Nazi propaganda had been anti-Christian since 1919, and the Jews sent to concentration camps were met there by Christians of conscience who arrived before the Jews. Now, I'm going to interject something here. I believe 1919 was the year of the creation of the Thule Society. As time passed, the resistance became more and more emphatic, and the price that individual Christians were willing to pay grew increasingly heavier. Carl Friedrich Gerdeler was a devout Christian. Gerdeler strongly opposed Nazi anti-Semitism. In Leipzig, he tried to stop the boycott of Jewish businesses. When the Nazis in 1936 ordered the demolition of a monument to Felix Mendelssohn, the great Jewish composer who converted to Christianity, Gerdeler tried to have it rebuilt. He traveled around the world warning anyone who listened of the dangers of Nazism and was the person selected by the conspirators to overthrow Hitler in 1944 to be the new Chancellor of Germany. He was arrested, brutally tortured, and finally executed by the Nazis. To the end, as a Christian, he opposed them even as he had from the beginning. Let me clear my throat. Klaus von Stauffenberg, the German general who almost killed Hitler in late 1944, was a devout Catholic who, because of his faith, was deeply opposed to the persecution of the Jews and considered that Kristallnacht in 1938 brought great shame upon Germany. Now, I'm going to interject something here. If you go to the Institute of Historical Review and do some research on that, you'll find out that all the evidence points to Kristallnacht as being a false flag by Jews against the Germans. And Hitler even spoke out against it, I guess perhaps not knowing for sure at the time what the story was. He spoke out against any of this persecution against the Jews. So, I mean, there's a huge conflict between what we are told is true and what the actual story is. Okay, because of his faith, was deeply opposed to the persecution of the Jews, and considered that Kristallnacht in 1938 brought great shame upon Germany. He was the man who tried to kill Hitler in 1944. Stauffenberg was, of course, arrested, tortured, and executed. Stauffenberg's wife, Countess Nina, who was pregnant with the couple's fifth child, was sent to Ravensbrück concentration camp. Ulrich von Hassell, although he joined the Nazi Party, wrote this in his diary about the same night of broken glass. I am writing under crushing emotions evoked by the vile persecution of the Jews after the murder of von Rath. Now, if I remember correctly, von Rath was a German was a German military officer who was in France. And everybody really needs to look into this. There's a book out written by a Jew called The Boy Who Started World War II. But the real story can be found in the Institute of Historical Review. A young boy, Jewish boy, walked into an embassy in France, a German embassy, and shot a military officer on, I guess it was called Armistice Day, the day in relating to World War I, when the hostilities ended, and killed him. And there's more to that. I won't go into it right now, but maybe I will in a future show, or you can do your own research into it. And that was the murder of Von Rath, if I remember correctly. That is his name. Both these men were murdered by the Nazis after the assassination of Hitler failed. Germans and Christians did not sit quietly while Nazis murdered Jews. Here, hold on a second here. Vile persecution after Jews and the murder of Von Rath. Yeah, that's what it was. That's what it was. That is Von Rath. Because what happened was they shot this military officer, and then they pulled a false flag in Germany and tried to blame it on the German people and say it was a response to the killing of this military officer, when in fact they did both deeds. Helmuth von Moltke, son and grandson of some of the most famous German military leaders, easily could have become a bigwig in the Nazi Party if he had chosen to do so. But von Moltke possessed strong Christian convictions and wrote in 1942, "Today is not a numerous but an active part of the German people are beginning to realize not that they have been led astray, but that what is happening is sin, personally responsible for each terrible deed that has been committed naturally, not in the earthly sense, but as Christians." In the same letter, von Moltke wrote that once he had thought that it was possible to totally oppose Nazism without believing in God, but now he declared that to be wrong, completely wrong, and that only by believing in God could one be an opponent of the Nazis. Von Moltke was arrested and executed by the Nazis in January 1945. The trial of Count Moltke in 1944 during the roundup of opponents to Hitler after the assassination attempt are telling. During his trial, the judge Friesler told Moltke, "Only in one respect does National Socialism resemble Christianity. We demand the whole man." After the trial, Moltke wrote, "I stood before Fiesler as a Christian and nothing else." And in a letter to his wife a few days before his execution, Moltke emphatically clear about what motivated him to oppose Hitler. "So then all that is left is a single idea, how Christianity can prove a sheer anchor in time of chaos." And I'm going to interject something here. Remember what I said about being in a foxhole with a Christian and a pagan? And the Christian can't be trusted? There you have it, right there. Christians are a liability. Gustav von Haften refused to join the so-called German Christian church establishment by the Nazis, and at great personal risk belonged to the real Christian church, the Confessing Church. He supported the attempts to overthrow Hitler and, like all other Christian martyrs, intervened whenever he could to protect Jews, to protest Nazi anti-Semitic policies, and to help Jews escape. He was tried and hanged by the Nazis in August 1944, where he described Hitler as the executioner of evil in history. Alfred Delp, who had entered the Society of Jesus, also tried to stop the persecution of Jews. And by the way, the Society of Jesus is the Jesuit Society. He was arrested, tortured, placed in solitary confinement, and finally executed in January 1945. These few names are but the tip of the iceberg of devout Christians who chose to oppose Hitler because of their faith and who died a horrible, lonely death because of that faith. I'm going to interject something here. Most of the men who received death sentences were either shot or they were hung with piano wire from meat hooks. Christians resisted the Nazis almost as soon as the Nazis came to power. In the end, Christians paid with their lives and the lives of their families, even though they were important Germans who would otherwise have been left alone, because the evil of Nazism was inconsistent with their faith. We have the words of these martyrs, which speak for themselves. I think there is two more chapters here, and it does not look like I could probably get through all of them in the next 8 minutes. And if you want to call in case I go over a little bit to hear, call in right now, 215-383-5775, just to listen. I'm not taking calls. And you got about 7.5 minutes to do so. I'm going to see if I can get through chapter 7, or part of it anyway. Let me see how many pages I got left here. Chapter 7 is pretty long. Chapter 8 is real short. Tell you what, based on that, I'm going to go ahead and stop here. And I will finish this in the next show, and then go the next show that I do on this topic. And I will, on that show, also go through all of the information from Allied Intelligence on this topic. So, anyway, let me get back to my notes here to finalize the show. And so, again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Some final thoughts. Truth does not fear investigation. Belief is when someone else does the thinking. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. There is no higher religion than truth. Religion leads to racial death. Racial death is forever. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan. And let me to the song. And I'll try and do a show in the next few days if possible. I don't know if I can do one tomorrow. I just don't know yet. I'm going to play it by ear. Where?
Satan!